This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of April 16th, here are a few top stories. In the news, Arizona teachers have voted to walk out, group organizers said on Thursday night. From KJZZ's education desk, Casey Kuhn reports.
The announcement comes after 3 days of teachers voting in schools across the state. The school tallies were sent to Arizona Educators United, the grassroots teacher group leading the Red for Ed movement, and tabulated. 57,000 teachers voted. There are about 60,000 teachers across the state, and 78% of them voted for the walkout. Noah Carvelis with Educators United says Governor Doug Ducey's plan for a 20% raise by 2020 is not enough.
We have crumbling public school infrastructure here right now. We have kids sitting in broken desks, studying out of 25-year-old textbooks in a room with a leaky ceiling, and that's unacceptable.
The walkout is planned for next Thursday. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
From the KJZZ original production, The Show, here's Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody.
Governor Doug Ducey toured the border near Yuma yesterday with U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, who continued to claim, quote, there is a crisis occurring on the border today, end quote, according to the Arizona Republic. As the first Arizona National Guard troops deployed to the area, Nielsen said the number of apprehensions of undocumented immigrants in that sector was, quote, too high, and that the administration must act immediately.
But not every Republican politician on the border agrees on the problem. Sheriff Mark Napier of Pima County was initially reticent when President Trump announced he would send National Guard troops to our border with Mexico, but he said he welcomed the support. There has been debate about whether this move is necessary right now. While the governor and others have cited statistics that show apprehensions in March were almost 3 times higher than they were in that month last year, overall, the number of migrants attempting to cross the border illegally is at a 47-year low. I took that question to Sheriff Napier, and I asked him why, in light of that, he's welcoming the support of the National Guard there now.
Well, I think the apprehensions is an illegal immigration issue, which I'm absolutely disinterested in. That's a federal problem. We know that the opiate crisis is a public health emergency, so declared by our governor in the state of Arizona and the president of the United States. The flow of illegal drugs coming up from the border, transnational crime threats, human trafficking, public safety issues are not on a decline, but rather to some degree on a rise. So I see it as an augmentation of public safety much more than I do from the federal immigration aspect. The president talks excessively about illegal immigration. I'm more interested in public safety. I'm interested in transnational crime threats and threats to public safety in Pima County. And undeniably, the porous border creates a public safety problem for the people of my county. So I welcome additional resources to interdict bad actors coming across the border, and there are plenty of those.
You've called what's happening in your county a human rights tragedy. Can you describe for us what's happening there right now and how your deputies play a role, like when someone calls 911 because migrants are lost in the desert?
Well, that's a great point. I speak out about this because it's something I'm very passionate about, and I think is really lost in the political rhetoric coming out of Washington, D.C., and even somewhat locally, is the porous border tacitly encourages people to come across the border undocumented into the deserts of Pima County. And there's environmental hazards there, which, of course, in the desert are undeniable. I mean, we're going to be up in 90 degrees, and the vastness of the desert creates an environmental challenge. But they're also victimized by bandits, coyotes, and the drug lords on the other side of the border that control these pathways into the United States. Unfortunately, a good many of these people end up dying in our desert. My deputies recover about 150 bodies a year in the deserts of Pima County, and those are only the bodies that we recover. We'll absolutely never know how many people are dead out there or what befell these people. And to me, that's a human rights tragedy, and we need to speak more forcefully about that. I mean, people are making desperate decisions. If your family were impoverished, if your family were in danger from drug lords, and you lived in Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, or Mexico, you might make a similar decision that some of these people are making, is the attempt to come here for a better life. Our immigration system is broken. That's a political problem that should be addressed in Washington, D.C. But many of these people are making desperate decisions, and because of environmental peril or being the victims of criminality. These people are dying in our deserts, and we need to look at securing the border to prevent that activity that is very dangerous.
So it sounds like you have the same goals as many of the people in this administration, as the president, in terms of securing the border, but it sounds like maybe for very different reasons. Like you said, the rhetoric that you're talking about with the human rights tragedy is very different than what we hear from the Trump administration. Do you think that they're missing the point? Do you think that immigration and the illegal trafficking of people who come across that border is a problem in itself?
Well, I'll make a lot of Republicans. I am a Republican sheriff. I'll make a lot of Republicans mad, but I absolutely think the discourse out of Washington, D.C. is getting in the way. We need to secure the border for three reasons. It is a public safety problem. That is undeniable. No one can argue that the porous border creates a public safety problem. It's a national security problem because we frankly don't know who's coming through the border. In the era of international terrorism and other transnational threats, that's not a good thing. It is a national security issue, and it's also a human rights problem. And we need to caption it from that way. We speak too much about illegal immigration, and vilifying our neighbors to the south. Mexico is not our enemy. They're not our enemy. They're our trading partner. They're our neighbor. And many people are making desperate decisions to come here. Should they do so legally? Absolutely. But should that legal process make more sense? Absolutely. We're now arguing what constitutes a wall. I'm not interested in that dialogue at all. What I'm interested in is securing the border for the three reasons I mentioned.
Do you think a wall would accomplish that?
Well, define a wall. You and I, if the president would ever say these words, I would fall out of my chair. A wall's an analogous term. A wall could mean technology. A wall could mean physical barriers. A wall could mean human resources or a blend of all of those things. There are places where physical barriers make absolute sense, and they're good tools to help secure the border. There are other places where technology is a much better tool, and we should use technology in those areas. And there are places where we could do better interdiction with human resources. But we need a thoughtful, eclectic approach to this problem. A wall is an interesting soundbite, but that is all it is. It is not public policy. And the international border is about 1,980 linear miles. If you started the wall in my office here in Tucson, Arizona, and kept going east, that wall would terminate somewhere outside of Charlotte, North Carolina. Does that seem feasible to anybody? The constant term, the wall, is getting in the way of real solutions.
So having these troops that will be or are on their way to the border, what do you think they can accomplish in terms of increasing security? You mentioned they may be helpful in helping to stop the drug trafficking that's coming across right now.
Well, they're certainly going to be able to free up some of the enforcement assets of the Border Patrol. So, for example, if you had an enforcement agent of the Border Patrol monitoring a camera, well, now we can redeploy that enforcement asset to the border region and put a National Guard support person monitoring cameras, looking at fixed sites, and being better eyes and ears and support for the Border Patrol. I am absolutely supportive of the Border Patrol's mission. One of the things that comes up that people don't talk enough about, and I really wish the Border Patrol would do a better job of publicizing, is how many times they save immigrants that have come across the border. We did an analysis last month in March. We had roughly over 100 calls that came into our communications center requesting Border Patrol, or that ended up with us requesting Border Patrol support. Do you know that the vast percentage of those were migrants in the desert who were lost, who were calling us to call Border Patrol to come and rescue them?
Like you said, this is not the rhetoric you're hearing from most Republicans, and you are a Republican. Are you getting pushback from some of your constituents, from people who voted for you? Do you think that that this is a difficult political position to be in as a Republican in this country right now?
Well, I'm a Republican, but my task is not partisan. It's public safety. I think the people of this county elected me to provide good stewardship over public safety, not to be a partisan mouthpiece. I'm absolutely a proponent of securing the border, but I think there are thoughtful ways to do that. So, yeah, I get a lot of pushback, but I told my family when I got elected, I'm willing to lose an election. I'm not willing to lose me or lose my ideals or compromise my integrity for political expediency. I think too many politicians do that, too many elected officials, and I think people should expect more, especially of sheriffs who are entrusted with public safety in their respective counties.
All right. That's Pima County Sheriff Mark Napier. Sheriff, thank you so much for your time today.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In science news, one of the world's largest, rarest, and foulest flowers bloomed on Thursday night at the Tucson Botanical Gardens. As Nicholas Gerbis reports from the Arizona Science Desk, it's been a long time coming.
Amorphophallus titanum, better known as the corpse flower for its signature rotting carcass odor, can take 7 to 10 years, or longer, to bloom. Now, at long last, the blessed day is upon Rosie, as the garden calls its 3-foot-tall plant. Corpse flowers, which are threatened by habitat loss in their native Sumatra, bloom for 24 to 36 hours and produce small reddish fruit. Those who cannot make it to Tucson, or would rather spare their noses the experience, can view a live stream on the garden's website. Nicholas Gerbis, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
From Fronteras, across the country, American Indian students consistently score lower than other racial groups on national standardized tests. Research shows today's Native youth still feel the impacts of a traumatic past, and that affects how they learn in English-only schools. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
We see the scenario play out again and again. Take the spelling bee. To qualify for the Scripps National Spelling Bee, students all over the country first have to pass a vocabulary test. On the Navajo Nation this year, only a handful of the tribe's top spellers passed. Those students then competed in a spelling bee to decide who will represent the tribe. The Navajo spelling champ 2 years running, Kelly Haven, a seventh grader from Fort Defiance.
I was so happy. I thought that this is my second chance. I can improve all of my mistakes from last year.
Last year in Washington, when it was Kelly's turn to compete against the top 300 kids in the country, she stood up on stage, scanned the crowd, and her mind went a complete blank. Kelly lost in the second round. Her mom, Dina Haven, says they felt a little out of their league.
Those kids are on a whole nother level than where we were. We had prepared her enough to get her there, but once we were there, it was a whole nother level.
Dina, who teaches high school English, says they had no idea what they were up against. Tutors, Latin classes, private schools.
They have so many more advantages to them, and you see that Kelly is just as good at it as they are. She says, you know, he's wearing a private school blazer, and I'm just as good as him. And we tell her all the time, you're a Navajo kid from the reservation, and you've made it this far.
To be a Navajo kid today often means living in poverty, getting up at 5 to ride a bus 2 hours to get to school.
When they get there, are they tired? Are they sleepy? Are they hungry? And then they get into school and teacher's cranky and they're just like, you know, I'm done with this.
Jacqueline Salabai is Navajo and a program manager at Native Americans for Community Action.
What's mom doing? What's dad doing? Are they worried about, gotta make bread, I gotta go haul some water, I gotta, you know, make sure the sheep are okay.
Salabai says so often parents are in crisis mode. Half of the tribe is unemployed. They don't know how they're going to feed their kids, let alone help them with their homework. Salabai says many blame these desperate circumstances on a long list of federal policies.
Relocation, the long walks, the reservations, forced religion, forced adoption and selling of children, loss of the family units, intentional sterilization, and also culturally biased laws, boarding schools.
For almost a century, the federal government forced Native Americans to attend boarding schools in an effort to wipe out their languages and cultures. Students were beaten for speaking their mother tongue. Today, only half of the Navajo Nation speaks their language. Robert Kelty is the principal of Puente de Hoyo, a language immersion school in Flagstaff. He says the only way to reverse the effects of trauma is through language revitalization.
No matter who kids are, every kid needs to be affirmed in their learning environment.
Kelty points to the research. A University of Arizona study shows Native children exposed to academic English only at school are often language delayed, and bilingual education can improve not only a student's confidence, but also their academic achievement. All but 2 schools on the Navajo Nation have an English-only curriculum, with Navajo taught 1 hour a week. The Department of Diné Education projects by 2020, only 30% of the tribe will speak its language.
When students are not affirmed in their identity and they want to be grounded in their culture, and they're not, that you can have a form of subtle resistance. And that can play out through the means of failing in disengagement in school.
Kelty says it's up to the adults, the educators, the policymakers, the parents, to fix that, because every child knows how to learn. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
You're listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In education news, school social workers help children and their families develop coping skills for life's biggest challenges. From KJZZ's education desk, Mariana Dale reports on a Paradise Valley program meeting students' needs with college interns.
Ingrid Ramos has four kids to take to school every weekday. Getting everyone and all their stuff in the car is a multi-step process.
Backpacks, lunch boxes, everything in the car. It's crazy every morning.
Then she starts work. Ramos runs her husband's landscaping business.
I'm the boss right now.
That's because her husband is in immigration detention in Florence. She says 2 years ago, he was arrested for a crime he didn't commit.
It's so hard for my kids because they love my husband. And at this point, we are fighting for him, but the process, it's so slow.
Ramos says her kids stopped sleeping and they cried all the time. Ramos didn't know how to help her family process their feelings. She could barely handle her own.
When all this happens, I don't have the minimum idea how I will deal with this. And I want to keep my kids safe and strong.
She turned to her neighborhood school, Aire Libre Elementary, where Janice Moore is the principal.
The greatest challenge is to meet the students' social-emotional needs before we can educate them, before they will open their minds to learning.
Most of the kids at Aire Libre come from low-income families, so it gets extra federal money and can afford a part-time social worker. Lori Madrid is a social worker in the same Paradise Valley School District and says there's not enough time to individually help every student who needs it.
I could probably get to maybe five of them within the day, and those were the five that had the biggest crisis.
It's estimated there are fewer than 500 social workers in Arizona's more than 2,000 schools. Frustrated, Madrid turned to the social work students she taught at ASU 3 years ago. They needed real-life experience, and the kids needed one-on-one attention.
You have to sometimes go to administrators and say, what's happening isn't working and it's not okay.
She asked the district to pilot an internship program in four schools. Madrid called the program Everybody Matters. She mentors the college interns who meet with the students weekly and teach them skills to reduce stress and improve their communication.
We also kind of help kids understand there's things in the world we can control and there's things that we can't. To help them focus on, in this day, in this moment, here's the thing that I can do to get by.
It's difficult to research social work because of its complexity, but some studies show students who go to schools with social workers improve their self-esteem and behavior and are more likely to graduate. The Everybody Matters program is now in 21 schools, including Aire Libre, where Principal Moore says attendance and academic achievement is up. She can also see the difference on her students' faces.
They just light up when they see their intern in a purple Everybody Matters shirt coming just for them. And, you know, I think that's what it's all about, to know you have one caring adult in your corner.
Mom Ingrid Ramos enrolled all three of her elementary age kids in Everybody Matters.
Hello.
Welcome to our home.
I visited her family on a recent Saturday. They'd just gotten home from breakfast, and her second oldest son practiced the cello.
My name is Steven, and I'm 10 years old.
Steven's in the honors program at Aire Libre, but when his dad went away, he didn't even want to go to school. He also did not want to discuss his feelings.
Like, sometimes you get too sad and don't want to talk about things.
He started seeing an intern through Everybody Matters. They'd throw a football together, and he eventually started to open up. Steven says he cries less now, and he's able to talk, even when he's sad.
I somehow gained the courage.
Courage that gives Steven the strength to go to school and keep learning, even when he can't predict what each day will bring. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, from the business desk, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody.
When you're looking at what's the next big thing, sometimes it's best to look at what's a current little thing. That's something my next guest does. Mark Penn is president of the digital marketing company, the Stagwell Group. He's been a consultant and pollster for Hillary and Bill Clinton and Microsoft, among others. His new book is called Micro Trends Squared, the new small forces driving today's big disruptions, and is a follow-up to his 2007 book, Micro Trends. Mark Penn joins me, and Mark, given that these micro trends are, by definition, kind of small up-and-coming kinds of things, how do you go about trying to identify them?
I think first I look at some of the bigger things that are going on, what I call the accordioning of life, where people used to be on their own for just a few years before they got married are now on their own for 10 or 15 years, where people in their 60s are kind of having a second life in many ways, and we've got record numbers of nonagenarians, where technology is having a huge influence in creating new jobs. So I look at those big trends, and then I take them down to something smaller, because to really understand the specific implications of the things that are happening.
Well, so how do you try to figure that out? I mean, for example, it's interesting that there are more, 90-year-olds living now, but like, how do you figure out what the significance of that is, or why something like that matters?
Well, I think that first we kind of establish, well, what's going on? Well, we discover, well, it's so far in America, it's gone from 700,000 people over 90 to 2.5 million. Then we check the census has projections that by 2050 it'd be 8 million people. So now what does that mean? Well, then we begin to look in different areas. It means that there's going to be a record number of home health aid jobs out there. That could be the number one job opening. It could be something, by the way, the technology or robots, if there's a shortage, comes in to say, hey, we can provide the kind of monitoring and video games and fun and entertainment that maybe if we can't get enough home health aides, then what does that say about Social Security and being able to pay Social Security? So what we try to do then is kind of think about the implications for that, because that's either how social policy is made or businesses or investments are made.
Let me ask you about a few of the micro trends that you identify in this new book. In the first one, you call adults with roommates, which suggests that, roommates aren't just for college or, a bunch of people living in an apartment or renting a house right after college anymore, that these are adults who are continuing to live with people that they're not related to.
See, and that brings together several trends, the footloose and fancy free that people are spending 10 or 15 years on their own, the growth in never married. And so it means this kind of communal roommate living, which is something that people just try to get away from as quickly as they can. And this becomes a kind of way of life that in the past it was just a really brief transitory phase. And, I think that then says a lot about how those folks will live, or what kind of housing they're going to need, what kind of leasing arrangements they're going to need to get it paid, and how they're going to feel differently about things.
One of the other micro trends you identify is you call them the new Luddites, people who are mixing old technology with new. So one of the examples you cited was people will have a kind of a smartphone, but it'll be a BlackBerry, something that was more popular maybe 10 years ago than, an iPhone or an Android phone now. What's leading people to want to do that?
Well, for every trend, there's a counter trend, and that's actually what makes it so difficult to understand society. Now, unlike Newton's second law, those counter trends don't have to be opposite and equal, but they're usually opposite and sometimes equal, sometimes smaller. In this case, some people get so turned off by technology, and one of the other trends is new addicts, where kids are so addicted to technology. They say, I don't want to live my life that way. I want to live the opposite of that. And so that's why on the trains we have the quiet car, but the quiet car is one out of 5 or 10 cars. And if you look at flip phone manufacturing, well, there's been a resurgence in people buying flip phones. They just don't want all that technology and all that complexity. And so they sold 2 million flip phones in America last year.
Hmm. Two of the other microtrends that you identify are ones that kind of seem to be at odds with each other. I want to get your take on that. There's a group of people that you call the speed eaters, who are basically people who, you know, mealtime is not really a time to be with family. They maybe order their food on an app or have it delivered in some way and then eat it as fast as they can to get on with other things. And then there's the work with limits crowd, which are people who are not willing to spend, you know, 60, 65, 70 hours a week at the office. They come in, do their job, or maybe decide to work part-time so they can be with their families or do other things. Are these really sort of the, not the polar opposites, but people who sort of have opposing viewpoints of being with family and loved ones?
Well, I do think you identify a good trend, counter trend, which is to say that the speed eaters are again, more likely people who are trying to maximize their work. We find most people at work now don't even take a lunch hour. I mean, they really have said, hey, I don't see eating as this big social daily activity that I want to engage in. I want to get my work done. I want to eat as quickly as possible. And as you say, quite the opposite. We also have a lot of people who say, you know what, either I don't have as many responsibilities or I have the responsibilities of kids, and I want more control over my work life. And I think that that's why we have record numbers of people working part-time. You know, microtrends like this, they coexist. That means they're separate marketplaces. I mean, that's the whole art, I think, of finding and exploiting the microtrend.
Well, so if I'm a business or to some extent a politician who is trying to reach members of one of these micro trends, do I almost sort of have to pick which direction I want to go? I mean, can I go after and target both the speed eaters and the work with limits crowd?
In that case, I don't think they're as oppositional. I mean, I don't think you can go after the old economy voters and get the Silicon Valley voters at the same time. So there are some that are truly impossible to do at the same time. A lot of products, you know, manufacturers, I think, try also to cover the lot here by having, you know, so much differentiation of their products or their manufacturing.
Based on your experience and on your research, what is the average lifespan of these micro trends?
Yeah, it's interesting. After I wrote my research, I was like, well, are these fads or not? The truth is, I had to wait 10 years for microtrends to turn over, for there to be enough new stuff in society to write the second book. And there are several that I retained from last time, Internet Marrieds, Impressionable Elites. I suspect if I want to write Microtrends Cubed, I'll have to do that about 10 years from now.
Mark Penn is author of the book Microtrends Square, The New Small Forces Driving Today's Big Disruptions. He's also president of the digital marketing company, the Stagwell Group, and has been a pollster and consultant for Bill and Hillary Clinton and Microsoft, among others.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.